Please take out your Bible or New Testament and turn to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 21 is where we're going to spend the majority of our time this evening. That's Revelation chapter 21. We'll begin reading in verse 1 here in just a moment. That's Revelation 21, beginning in verse 1, as we continue our discussion tonight of these glimpses of glory. Last week we talked about that holy city, the city of God, and we glimpsed some glory of what heaven's going to be like by comparing it to that city. And I had a brother who came up to me right after the lesson, and he appreciated the sayings that were said, but his comment was something that really struck me. He said, "I've always been told that we just can't understand the images of heaven, but I understood that." And it's true that we can't understand the reality of heaven. And I think that's a lot of times what we say. What will heaven really be like? Well, we can't comprehend it because it's in the spiritual realm. But I'm afraid sometimes that keeps us from really studying the images of heaven that we are given. The images are here because they are things that we can understand, that give us a glimpse of God's glory. We can understand, to a certain degree, a city of complete safety, where the walls are high and thick, where the gates are open because there is no danger. We can understand a city of eternal permanency. No, we can't really understand eternity, but we can have a glimpse of what a permanent city is going to be like. Yes, we can understand to a certain degree the incredible size where all who desire can come into this city if they so desire. We can understand to a certain degree, a city that's from Georgia to, let's say, Atlanta, Georgia, all the way to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and all the way up to Canada. And then you go up that same 1,500 miles. What a city! We can see that that kind of city is large enough to have all of those who desire to be saved in it. And yes, we can imagine a city with wonderful people that we want to be with, the very best of the people of God. That sounds wonderful, and it should. It is a glimpse of what heaven will be like. And even catching a glimpse should make us yearn for that city. I'll be honest with you, I've really, really enjoyed preparing for these lessons. It has been so encouraging to me to see these images of where we're going. Ultimately, why we do what we do, so that we might be with God in this place and have this relationship with Him. And may I suggest that the second image, the image that we will study tonight, is even more relatable to us than that of a city. The second glimpse of glory that we see in the book of Revelation is that of the bride of Christ. So begin reading with me, if you would, in Revelation 21, beginning in verse 1. "Now I saw," John says, "a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth have passed away. Also there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people. God Himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away.'" Then drop down to verse 9. "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, 'Come, and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife.' And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." I'll admit to you, as I was studying, teaching the book of Revelation this last quarter and the quarter before, when I was studying this passage, I came across something that I'd never really noticed before. In Revelation chapters 21 and 22, you have this great image of the heavenly Jerusalem, of heaven itself. And yet, isn't it odd what angel is coming to show John these things? In verse 9, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me saying, come up here and I'm going to show you all of this. What is that angel doing there? Why did he identify this one, one that has all of these bowls of wrath and plagues and so forth? Why is that the angel that is coming to show John these things? It just seemed a little out of place to me. And so I just went and I looked. I ran the references and said, okay, where else have we seen that? Because in the back of my mind, there was this little tickling. Maybe we have seen that before. Maybe we have heard that before. And so I want you to turn back in your Bible to Revelation chapter 17. Because it should remind us of something. The bride that is described here in Revelation 21 should remind us of another personified city. A city that is personified as a woman in chapter 17. Notice the similarities that we see here of the angel that is presenting these things. Then one of the seven angels, chapter 17 and verse 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you. That is almost verbatim what we had back there in chapter 21. But here he is showing you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit. Again, almost identical language to chapter 21, into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Wait, stones and precious stones and gold and pearls? That all sounds familiar. Having in her hand a golden cup full of the abominations of the fullness of her filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. I saw her, and I marveled with great amazement. The bride is not just a beautiful image for us to see in the book of Revelation. She is also a powerfully vivid contrast. The contrast between the bride and the harlot. Revelation chapter 17 and Revelation 21 are really a tale of two cities, a tale of two women. And if we are going to fully appreciate the bride in all of her glory, we must as well see the harlot in all of her filthiness. And so from the end of the Bible, let us go back to the beginning. I ask the question, why did God create marriage? Because to understand this image of the bride, we first must understand that image of marriage and why God established this relationship. Go back to Genesis chapter 2, if you would. The story of man and woman begins with a wedding. It begins with a marriage, with a bride and her bridegroom. In Genesis chapter 2, read with me, if you would, there in verse 23 and 24. Now, we understand that it was not good for man to be alone. God creates this woman out of the rib of man, and he brings her to the man, and this is what Adam says in verse 23. And Adam said, this, at last, is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. Why did God create marriage? Lots of reasons. Companionship, friendship, the oneness. It's not good for man to be alone. Certainly the idea of a family unit and continuing with mankind as they procreate and go on in their lives. But may I suggest that one reason that God created marriage that sometimes we overlook, God created marriage to show us what covenant love is supposed to look like. God created this relationship to teach us about our relationship with Him, what it could be like in perfection. In this relationship of marriage, we enter into a covenant with one another, a covenant with God, a relationship where we are supposed to put to death me for we. The man was to cleave to his wife, to become one flesh with her. And all of this is a type, a foreshadowing of our relationship with God, and specifically our relationship with Christ. Turn in your New Testament to Ephesians chapter 5, if you would. Ephesians chapter 5. Come on, turn with me. Ephesians chapter 5. Let's look there in verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this reason, again, quoting from what we read in Genesis chapter 2, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now, as the Apostle Paul uses the imagery here, what he's trying to do is showing us how Christ treated the church. Now, husbands and wives need to treat each other in that same way. But that illustration works the other way as well. When a husband and wife are living as they ought to with one another, it shows us what the relationship between Christ and his church should be, between Christ, the Lamb, and his bride, what that should be like as well. And isn't it amazing that God in his foreknowledge, God in his wisdom, he established a relationship from the very beginning to teach us a lesson about what our relationship with him was supposed to be like. This is a big reason that God uses that comparison of Christ and the church, husband and wife. Here's the illustration. These two things are alike, he says. And scoffers, they look at the Bible and say, well, we've made God like man. But the easy response to that is to say it only stands to reason that an all-powerful God would create a world that would teach us about him, filled with examples and illustrations and shadows of his true nature. An all-powerful God is going to leave us glimpses of his glory in all sorts of different ways. Doesn't that just make logical sense? And God desires covenant love and relationship with us. And so he created this relationship of a man and a woman to be joined in marriage so that we might see what that love is supposed to be like. And it's not like getting to Ephesians 5, we're blindsided by this illustration. It's not like this is a new comparison between God and his people. The image of a husband and a wife, God and his people, is very common in the Old Testament as well. Just two examples, the book of Hosea and Ezekiel in the prophets. The book of Hosea vividly portrays that very concept that God and his people are husband and wife. Now, it's in a much more negative sense than Ephesians chapter 5. Here, there is a bride, a wife, who becomes a harlot, selling herself for money. And ultimately, Hosea, who is illustrative of God in this very vivid example, he has to go and redeem Gomer. He has to bring this woman who is supposed to be his wife but has gone after harlotry. He has to bring her back, has to buy her back. Ezekiel describes this relationship in even more graphic language. God saves this woman to make her his wife. And he gives her everything, love and blessing. And she turns away from him and runs after other lovers. She won't even take payment for her infidelity. She has totally defiled herself. And so what we see in the Old Testament is that this comparison is very negative in nature. God's people are not faithful like they ought to be. But we get to the New Testament, and the bride is pure again. Christ has sanctified her and cleansed her by the washing of water by the Word. He presents her to Himself as a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish before Him. This bride is made up of those who love God, who desire and choose to be with God. And Christ, the Lamb, is portrayed as the bridegroom. Again, let us see this contrast of the bride and the harlot and make some application to what this means about heaven. What does the image of a bride imply? Just like we think about a city and the implications there, what about this of a bride? Well, first, a bride implies priceless value. Turn again to the book of Revelation. This time, we'll pick up reading in verse 10 where we left off. That's Revelation 21 and verse 10. And He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, her light. So again, this city and bride, that metaphor is being mixed here. Her light was like most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. She had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates, the names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And we see that it's laid out in this great cube, as we talked about before. And He measures the walls and all of these sorts of things. But drop down to verse 18. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass. Have you ever seen transparent gold? Think about that. It was pure gold as clear glass. How pure does the gold have to be transparent? I remember back when I was buying Stephanie her diamond. How many C's are there? There are 4 C's maybe, right? Cut, carat, something, and clarity. Clarity is the one I knew, right? You want it to be clear, and the clearer it is, the more valuable it is. Well, how valuable is this gold that it's transparent? You can see through it. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. And He lists these stones that are found there. And to be perfectly honest, we don't know exactly what all of these stones are. Some of these translations into English are just guesses on our part. But what we do know about them is that they are valuable. Verse 21, the 12 gates were of 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. There it is again. So I wanted to see what these stones look like in real life. And so I went on to Amazon and I looked around and I found this board that was laid out that had all of these stones on it. It looked like it was probably about yay big, right? And you have these stones that you can see on it. So I paid, I won't tell you how much I paid. I paid too much to get this in the mail. My own fault, right? Should have read the fine print. But why are the stones so small? They're beautiful. I'll leave it up here so you can come and see it. Well, because some of these have some value to them. An emerald? All of them have beauty. But imagine that you go into the nicest jewelry store that you can think of. You go to Tiffany's in New York or whatever the case might be, and you go in there and you see all of these precious stones and all of their value. Now imagine that each of those stones was enlarged thousands and thousands and thousands of times, maybe millions of times, to where they become the foundations of this city that is 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. And the quality of those stones is perfect. Every single one of them. Can you imagine the value that is found in that? Even if we just take these 12 gates, they're 12 pearls. Each individual gate is one full pearl. And you take this pearl and you cut it to where it opens, and now it's a gate, right? I get in trouble when I try and make these comparisons, but I'm going to do it anyway. This is the largest pearl that has ever been discovered. 75 pounds. It was hidden for a decade. The next largest one is maybe a little less than 50 pounds smaller than this. That's pretty incredible size for a pearl, isn't it? You know that smaller one, the next largest that had been around for a long time, how much do you think it was valued at? Now this was in 2003, the last time they did an evaluation of that pearl, and it was worth $93 million. How much could this mangled, gnarly looking thing be worth? Nine digits for sure, hundreds of millions. And what we see are 12 pearls in this city, large enough to carve a gate out of each one. And each one of these pearls is perfect. We know that story from the New Testament, from the Gospels, of the pearl of great price, and how this one, when they find that pearl, they go and they sell everything that they have that they might gain this pearl. And the pearl is representative of the kingdom. But you think about that. Somebody's willing to do that for this precious stone. Now we have 12 of them the size of gates. And they're used as gates. That's what they are. These other precious stones, they're used as foundations. People are walking on the transparent glass because it's the city. It's like back in the 30s where they're making all the streets out of bricks. Well, it's golden bricks. Let's just go and take Fort Knox and build all those streets out of them. That's how much value we're talking about in this place. But really, monetary value is not the point, is it? If we think about our contrast, I don't mean to be crude, but the price of a harlot is set in a very literal sense. You pay a price to have her. How much is she worth? Well, you can find out. So, so sad, isn't it? But a good wife, a bride whom you love, how can you put a price on that? Isn't that the point in Proverbs 31? If you turn back there with me, Proverbs 31. Here is the climax of the book of Proverbs, written to a young man by his father. And then at the end, we get some words from this father's mother, the grandmother. And it describes a good wife, a virtuous wife. How much is she worth? In Proverbs 31, beginning in verse 10, who can find a virtuous or an excellent, a worthy wife? For her worth is far above rubies. She's worth far more than all these precious stones we've been talking about. The heart of her husband safely trusts in her. We drop down to verse 23. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land because of her influence in his life. Drop down to verse 26. She opens her mouth with wisdom. On her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all, they say to her. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. Praise her in the gates of these cities in ancient times. Praise her in the gates of that city to come. Her worth is far above rubies. And the advice given to a young man is this. Don't go after an idolatrous woman, which we see earlier in this book. Don't go after an immoral woman, which we see earlier in this book. Go after a woman like this. And heaven is described in those terms. of a bride whose value is far, far above any rubies, any monetary value. So a bride implies priceless value, but it also implies perfect purity and holiness. It is a bride adorned in white. And even in our culture, that idea of the purity of the bride is something that we see in terms of that whiteness. It is a common theme in Revelation that the people of God are dressed in white. We have been made pure by the blood of the Lamb. Purity and holiness are emphasized. And we see that emphasized in this city of heaven itself. Go again to Revelation 21. This time, read verse 8 with me, please. Revelation 21 and verse 8. Making a contrast with those whose names are found in the Lamb's Book of Life. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. None of those will be found in heaven. Instead, what do we find if we drop down to verses 26 and 27? And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into this city. But there shall be by no means enter it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Holiness and purity is what we find in a bride. That's what we find in this city as well. There are a number of places in the Old and New Testaments that call our minds to this sort of imagery, but one of the best is perhaps in Zechariah chapter 14. So go to the Old Testament, very end of the Old Testament, second to last book in our Old Testaments, and go to the last chapter in that book, Zechariah chapter 14. The day of the Lord is presented in terms of the coming deliverance. And I think what really we see here with this prophet is looking forward to this new Jerusalem, this glorified heaven where God is. We see in verse 4, and in that day His feet, the feet of the Lord, will stand on the Mount of Olives. We think about Christ coming into the city of Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, and our attention should be perked to this. Verse 6, and it shall come to pass in that day that there will be no night. The lights will diminish. It shall be one day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time it shall happen that it will be light. Again, light is everywhere. And in that day it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem. In Revelation 22, we see those living waters coming from the throne. Half of them toward the eastern sea, half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter, it shall occur. As we sang a moment ago about those living waters filling up the sea, that's what we see here in this glorified New Jerusalem. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be, the Lord is one, and His name one. Now skip forward to what it will be like in this place and in this time. Look there in verse 16. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And what will it be like in the city when we see these things? Notice verse 20. In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved where? On the foreheads of the high priest, engraved on the bales of the horses. It's holy down to the bells that are on the horses. And not just the bells on the horses, the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. Common cooking utensils will be as holy as what we see in the temple itself. Some of our good, close, wonderful friends that we love so much clearly don't love us as much because they went to my favorite steakhouse without us and didn't invite us. I learned about this at lunch. But apparently while they were there, they saw back into the kitchen and saw that they weren't washing the dishes exactly the way they ought to. We don't want to know what goes on in the kitchens of restaurants, right? Just show us the food, we'll eat it, and hopefully not get sick on it. But can you imagine all of those dishes in every home and every pot being as holy as what you present before the Lord in the temple. How holy must the city be for even the bells of the horses to be holy? Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them, and in that day there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Only those who are faithful to God, only those who love Him will be there, and they will be His holy people. Everything is holy, and that's what is implied by this bride. But that's not all. May I suggest one of the greatest things that's implied is the breathtaking beauty of the bride. All of these precious stones are not just about value, they're about beauty. It is a rainbow, a kaleidoscope of colors reflecting the brilliance of God. I struggled. I searched for a couple of hours trying to find an image that could somehow capture this. And you can't find one that's any good. But you see here all of these foundations of these different stones, and imagine the light of the Lord coming through all of those stones. What must that look like in its brilliance and in its beauty? This is not a lusty, trashy hotness. It's not immodesty masquerading as beauty as with the harlot, but a pure, breathtaking beauty. There is a beauty to a bride that is unlike anything else. I have watched in my lifetime several brides walk down the aisle toward me. That doesn't sound quite right, does it? Here's the most recent. Isn't Rance cute? It's a really neat experience to be there and you're standing next to the groom and he is nervous as a cat. Not just Rance, everyone I've ever stood by. And then there's some doors that open and there's his bride. And all of a sudden he grows still, because this is the moment he's been waiting for. This is the one that he's been waiting for. And seeing her radiance and beauty as she walks down the aisle, few things like it. And as cool as it is that I get to see that with others, nothing compares to seeing it with your own bride. Weren't we so happy? I'm going to get in trouble just by putting this picture up here. But can I just say, I guess I can't say it. The beauty of your bride is like nothing else. And she's more beautiful now to me in every way. As beautiful as she is nothing compared to the beauty of heaven. Studying that this week, that was a glimpse for me. I don't know how beautiful it's going to be, but how beautiful it must be. We sing a song just like that. How beautiful heaven must be. No, I can't grasp it, but I can lay hold of the image and get a glimpse of it. And then finally, what does the image of a bride imply? It implies covenant unity and intimacy and permanency. Go back again to Revelation 21. We read this a second ago, but let's read again so that we might emphasize verses 12 through 14. Of Revelation 21. Start there in verse 12. And she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So we think about God's people in the Old Testament, right? Three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, three gates on the west, Anybody that wants to get in can. There's plenty of room. It's not like these big stadiums that they build and then it takes you, you know, an hour to get out. It takes you an hour to get in. No, there's plenty of availability so that you can come into this. But notice verse 14. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So we have the 12 tribes of Israel. We have the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And those 12 tribes and 12 apostles symbolize the covenant unity that God had with His people in those days and the covenant unity He has with people in these days. It is all of God's people, past, present, and future, who are found here in this city. And the more we value marriage, the more we can imagine heaven, whether by contrast or by comparison. And you don't have to have a great marriage to see this image. I know maybe, especially the last point, maybe that was difficult for some of you. Because your marriage isn't or wasn't what you wanted it to be. But yes, contrast does the same thing. Even in those types of marriages, what if? What could it have been like? Now imagine a million times better. Because you see, here is the reality. The ultimate marriage, the very best, is just a dim foreshadowing to the unity and intimacy. We're one flesh in marriage. It's just a dim foreshadowing. And permanency, till death do us part, of what we will have with God. With God, it is not just one flesh. No, we are one in every way with Him, total and complete unity. With God, it is not till death do us part. We will never be parted. There is no death anymore. We will be with Him, united for all eternity, in every way. It bothers me that marriage will end. I don't know if anybody else thinks about that, but I do. It bothers me that marriage is going to end. Here, God has told me to have this relationship, and it's for life, and so on and so forth. It's permanent. But in heaven, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Marriage ends in death. I think about a great uncle and great aunt that I have, my Uncle Johnny and Aunt Carolyn. No one that I've ever known loved each other more than those two. My Uncle Johnny died a few years ago, very suddenly. And some of you know my Aunt Carolyn, and it's tough for her to even talk about him. She loves him so dearly, even now. And she would rather talk about him than not talk about him. But she misses him. I want to be married to Stephanie forever. That's what I want. But God in His wisdom, that's not the way it works. Why not? Well, a couple of reasons come to mind. Number one, not all of our spouses will be there. And that breaks my heart to even think about that. But even if you're both there, you're not going to be married anymore. The relationship is going to be different. Why? Well, I think the more important thing is this. What that emphasizes to us, this relationship that God started way back there in the beginning in Genesis chapter 2, it emphasizes that this relationship, as big and powerful and important as it is just a glimpse. It is just a type. It is just a shadow of something far, far greater. Marriage ends in death. But there is no death there. What a city. No, what a bride. I think I like imagining the bride even better. What a glimpse of glory we're given by God. It is a place, a real place, for real people. It is a relationship, a real relationship that people are really going to have. And it can be yours. It can be mine. It can be ours. Don't you want to go there? I hope you've gotten a glimpse, just enough to desire it and do whatever is necessary to be a part of that city of God. And if we can help you to go there even tonight, won't you come now while together we stand and while we sing?